Kyle is right. Like, his criticism of GM is apt. The thing is, though, is that he is GM's counterparty in this round of this behavior. So he is not the guy to be pointed at, right? Like, it's not that what he say, to quote Marge Simpson, he's right, but he shouldn't say it. Like, he's not the guy to be making this criticism.
Are you citing the Wheel of Fortune episode of The Simpsons? Oh my God, that is bad citation. But go on.
Folks outside the automotive world, like, just who maybe don't follow who any of the executives are, because the handle is the last name, but it's not like super obvious, I guess, might not know that the president of GM, Mark Royce, commented on it with just one word, which was kind of like a Michigan fuck off. And it just was nice with an exclamation point. Hello and welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
And I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors.
And I'm Alex Roy, the founder of the Human Driving Association and co-founder and principal at the finest, the most insightful strategic advisor in transportation, Johnson & Roy. And today our, unofficial guest is Patrick Hunt, former executive with Rivian and with Our Next Energy. I happen to be visiting his office, and he's agreed to join us and keep to himself unless asked a direct question, because he knows too much and he has to be extra cautious. Welcome.
I have lots of direct questions to ask Patrick, but I don't know if he'll answer any of them.
He's not going to answer any of them.
He's not really so much a guest as a friend of the show who happens to be stopping by. How's it going, Patrick?
It's great to be here. Long time, first time.
You know, it's wild. I'm up here visiting Traverse City, but actually Petoskey, Michigan, where Patrick's spending the summer. And I had no idea that basically the who's who of automotive technology and OEMs all have homes up here. I've seen more nice cars, more interesting people here in one day than I've seen in years outside the Autonicast party.
I mean, Michigan's where it all happens, baby.
Yeah, it's amazing. And also, last night saw Patrick and a friend of his who knows also my friend and I think friend of the show, Nick Twork, how small is that world, who just formerly of RNX Energy and Argo AI, who's now head of marketing communications at Lucid. The world is small. We have to stay objective and above it. And that's why Kirsten is here to lead the episode's first topic. Kirsten?
Okay. Well, we have a few things to talk about today, but I think Ed really wants to kick things off with a spicy fight on X. Ugh. And we're not talking about the VCs of Silicon Valley. That's another dumb fight.
That's for a different podcast.
Yeah, that's for a different podcast and one that I won't be listening to.
What is it this time? Is it not
this
Tesla?
Time, no, it's not Tesla. So GM has decided in they disclosed it in their second quarter earnings that the Origin, this is the custom built ground up shuttle toaster oven looking like AV that was unveiled in January 2020. I was at that.
I was there too. I remember that was.
Yeah.
I was not invited.
Oh, huh, funny. Because I think you funny. Were working for a competitor maybe at the time.
Yeah. But they're scrapping it. And so they have made a number of these Origins. I actually reached out and asked them, so what happens to all these old Origins? And was told, don't worry, they'll be put to good use. And I don't know what that means. But
I would love to buy one and make it human driven and cannonball in it.
So it's funny too, Kirsten, because remember, so we were at the unveil, which was, it was pre-pandemic. And then they showed a different, right? They sort of iterated on that design, right. And they should have at South by Southwest. You and I checked that out, and like they had modified it quite a bit. So like a lot of resources went into not just creating a prototype here, but like really developing that into something that they were right about to put on the streets.
Is it $583 million of resources?
Yeah. So they're taking almost 600.
That is the right jump that they shared in their earnings. So they've spent at least that. Now also this was supposed to be a collaboration. The design and development of it was in collaboration with Honda, and you could see these Honda-like elements within it. That was early days. But just to give folks a reminder on the timeline here, a year ago at South By is when Ed and I saw the retooled, sort of improved version of the Origin. They were announcing, Mary and Kyle Vogt, who was the co-founder and now former CEO of Cruise, was on stage. And there was like this push, right, to show Austin as the next place. The Origin was going to launch there. That was March 2023. By December 2023...
Seems so long ago.
I know. So within the span of that time frame, Kyle was no longer CEO. He resigned. The Cruise lost all of its permits for California to operate. Then they voluntarily suspended operations everywhere else. 24% of its workforce was cut. And GM kind of circled the wagons and started, you know, basically bringing some people in. And this is all because of the incident that happened October 2nd, which was a robotaxi on the streets of San Francisco struck a pedestrian after it had been hit by a human-driven car, and then ran over the car and then dragged that person. And the sort of how that was handled, plus the technology of that happening, is what led to that those permits being revoked. So this has not been that long, right? Like not that long. A year ago, things were looking very bright and shiny.
Well, for not GM if you asked behind closed doors. I was telling people that Cruise years in advance. But before we go any further, Patrick, if you were to say anything about on this topic, would you like to say it now? Because you built production lines at Rivian. You were there early on. And my question is, when you have a factory that's churning out a vehicle like an Origin, right? It's very expensive to build. It exists. You're churning these things out. Kirsten, how many of these things they build? A couple hundred of them?
I don't know if they've ever shared the number, but I've heard a couple hundred. I mean, they were definitely testing them. We know that. So
Patrick, you've got a production line, you stand it up, you start turning these things out, you shut it down. How hard is it to spin up that line again in a year or 3 years or 5 years? What does that look like? How hard is that?
Well, first I'll say I was more on the strategy and commercial side than, you know, building lines. But I think the volumes that we're talking about here are still pretty low. So I don't know how far into kind of spinning up a line they got. If it's only 583 million, then they weren't putting together the CapEx for like a production line for these things. You know, so it's probably pretty low volume type operations still.
Soft, do you think they made the right decision?
You know, what I think is interesting is this accident didn't involve an Origin, did it?
No.
Right. So it's interesting to just think about how like this accident cascaded a bunch of kind of org changes in perspective that now resulted in this decision, which is pretty separate. It's about the business case and where the technology works best.
Yeah.
But it's probably the right decision because I don't think we need dedicated vehicles yet.
Mm. Right. So to close the loop on this, before I jump in, the decision wasn't just we're scrapping the Origin. It also came with, oh, the next gen Chevy Bolt, which is coming by around the end of this year into next year, I believe, it, as a passenger vehicle, which they're going to sell, will also be tooled for an AV version. So this is what's happening now at the Orion assembly plant. I've been there, had the tour. There is the, or was the Chevy Bolt that people could buy, and then an AV version of it. That had redundancies built in that, you know, a passenger or a human driven version didn't need. So basically what's
Ed, before you go, sorry, Kirsten, go on, I have a question for you.
Well, no, so basically what's going to happen, is what was already happening. It's just going to be the next gen version. And my assumption is that it will continue at Orion because that's where the original Chevy Bolt AV version for Cruise was being built.
Kirsten, did you see, or can you even tell us, how about use hand signals? Did you see the next generation Chevy Bolt? If you can't say it, use hand signals. She didn't see it. Because I'd love to know if that next generation Bolt has sufficient luggage capacity for three to four people, a family needs to go to and from an airport to carry the luggage necessary for a trip. Because that is going to be the game changer, which, if they can get their software sorted out, would unlock a key route, which is airport to downtown and back. Because without that, Waymo has won for a generation of vehicle.
Well, so when we saw the origin at the original unveil, the first version of it, there was nowhere to put the luggage. Like literally they said, oh, you just sort of like put it in the floor in between the sort of club seating or whatever. And then in the second version
of it. Yeah,
it
was like meant to be like a subway type style where, you know, you come in with your suitcase and you put it between your, you know, like legs or next to you if it's crowded, or if it's not crowded, you put it next to you. I think that was the format they were going.
But in the evolved version that we saw as they were getting closer to production at South by Southwest last year, they had a trunk then in the back. I think the whole thing was maybe a little lower down, so kind of more freeway speed. And I think what was really fascinating to me was seeing like how that evolution from that 2019 prototype to the new one, which showed how much they were putting the literal cart before the horse, right? Because they were like, oh, we need to have this robo-taxi. But they really hadn't thought through what the product was like, right? And between that prototype and that's what you do, right? You show a prototype and then you evolve it. But this whole origin thing has always been for me like, well, we have to do it because it somehow makes this all like feel real or worth it or whatever. And like, I think what's interesting is that so and kind of getting to the heart of the juicy part of this story, I feel like now, which is that Kyle Vogt, you know, went and took a shot at GM for canceling this. And, you know, his quote is, so GM repeatedly finds themselves with a 5 to 10 year head start, but then fumbles the ball, shuts things down and loses the lead. Anyone remember the EV1? It's like someone keeps letting them look into a crystal ball and then they just go, nah, we're good. So he posted that on X. And look, like,
I mean, is it wrong?
I started my career as a GM hater. Like, there's no one who goes in for a little GM hating quite like I do. And like, historically, the pattern that he's describing is absolutely something that GM does. The thing is, though, is that it's never just GM. There's always like, it's either someone who comes in or there's partner, whatever. But in this case specifically, right? So, it's totally fine to point out this pattern at GM and as a criticism and you know, hopefully they can do better in the future. But like Kyle Vogt is the guy who pitched and sold GM on this whole thing. And his narrative that GM had a head start is pretty self-serving. Like Cruise was early, but like, I don't know. I mean, what I heard about sort of, you know, the conditions of that company when they got that initial $1 billion investment, like, it was a demo. GM spent $1 billion on a demo. Like Kyle suckered them into this thing, you know, and they put a ton of money into it. I'm guessing, I'm not sure, but I'm guessing that Kyle and Cruz were the ones who pushed for GM to build a completely bespoke vehicle. I doubt that was completely like GM saying we have to do this.
Doesn't that feel like a GM thing to do though, because of the efficiencies piece of it, and also, you know, the whole pitch with the Origin, and by the way, Waymo has kind of done the same thing, which is a ground up redundant vehicle that can serve people with disabilities. So if people who use wheelchairs, it will fit more people. It will be more efficient. This is not just a purpose-built vehicle, so it's the best for the use case, but also the most cost-efficient. Therefore,
but they didn't understand the use case when they started doing it.
Hold on, let's ask Kirsten. Can Zeekr accommodate a wheelchair?
No, I mean you've seen this. You've seen the vehicle.
I can't remember.
Unless it's changed. No, but it, no, we went and saw that prototype And as far as I remember, no, it didn't have a ramp. The Origin did. I mean, they made kind of a big deal about it. It was actually the picture that Kyle shared when he made his spicy comments on X.
This sure sucks for all the outreach they've done to the disabled community.
Just to finish the thought, I'm not absolving GM here, right? Like GM, Kyle is right. Like, his criticism of GM is apt. The thing is, though, is that he is GM's counterparty in this round of this behavior. So he is not the guy to be pointed at, right? Like, it's not that what he say, to quote Marge Simpson, he's right, but he shouldn't say it. Like, he's not the guy to be making this criticism.
Are you citing the Wheel of Fortune episode of The Simpsons? Oh my God, that is bad citation. But go on.
No, anyway, it's just bald. I mean, look, Kyle has sailed off to his next, you know, hype surfing startup. He's in home robotics now, because that's definitely the big thing. You know, his pocket is lined with GM's money. GM is sitting there eating the bill. Kyle's employees are the ones who are getting laid off. Like, I just don't know. Like, his sense of smugness about this is really, it's exactly the kind of off-putting stuff that I think, and we discussed this on the show quite a bit, a huge part of Cruise's failure was about communications and the public profile that company cut. And this quote from Kyle, like, a totally different context, totally different situation, totally different topic, but the attitude shows he didn't learn a damn thing from it. And
Kirsten, what was the most interesting comment you observed and put in your newsletter around this debacle?
You mean the newsletter that you don't read?
I don't have to, because I follow the news in other ways.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but then you wouldn't get my, like, pithy writing. You know, you can find the news another way, but you're missing out.
Listen, the newsletter is for people who want to know stuff, like, 1 minute slower than I want to learn it. Is that okay.
Yeah, you go directly to the source. All right, well, so what...
I just call you.
Yeah. So what you're referring to is... The news comes out a few hours later. Kyle posts on X the quote that Ed read, and I, you know, retweeted it, and others did too, and commented on it. But then an interesting person commented on it as well. And folks outside of the automotive world, like, just who maybe don't follow, I don't know, who any of the executives are, because the handle is the last name, but it's not, like, super obvious, I guess, might not know that the president of GM, Mark Royce, commented on it with just one word, which was kind of like a Michigan fuck off. And it just was nice with an exclamation point. I'm pretty sure that was like a sarcastic nice. I don't think it was
Patrick, you want to put that into a Midwest translator for us?
Nice. Like,
bless your heart.
Bless your heart. Yeah, exactly. That's the Southern version.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess none of you think, will Kyle ever have a project again in transportation? Ever?
Oh, no. What OEM would touch him after this?
I mean, people have short memories, I'll tell you.
Well, and Kyle has this going for him. No matter what he possibly says, he'll never be the biggest douchebag in driving automation technology. And to cite that, to back that up with a specific source, someone else waded into this conversation, of course. And, you know, so GM, and that's actually an interesting thing we haven't discussed, which is that right, GM has been trying to get exemptions from FMVSS, Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, to put vehicles on the road without human controls for longer than anyone, and they've never been able to do it, which I think is a really...
Since before the Origin, to be clear.
Before the Origin, exactly. Yeah. And so that's a subtext to all this. I don't know why they've struggled so much to do it. We know that other companies have been able to get exemptions. They've been able to cut deals with NHTSA, and I don't know why GM has struggled for so long without really being able to get that. But GM sort of used that as an excuse or a reason for cutting the Origin, which is, like, a good one. And Elon Musk had to weigh in on this, and he said,
"No way, quote, no way,
yes, way, way." And this is from Market Watch. He says, Obviously, the real reason they canceled is because GM can't make it work, he said. Don't blame the regulators. That's misleading. Waymo, Alphabet's AV unit, is, quote, doing just fine, Musk said. So.
Okay.
No, you were obviously not. You obviously did not listen to the Tesla call.
I did. I actually didn't get to the very end. I got to the point where he said we're entering an age of superabundance and the end of scarcity. And I, like, my body had this physical reaction and I had
to stop. That's when you jetpacked out. You jumped off the cliff.
I couldn't do it anymore.
He so was this also must have been after that. Really difficult to understand this this earnings. I don't know if you noticed that. And so I don't know if it was like, you know, ketamine kicking in or just lack of sleep. But what he said was really fascinating to me because he blamed something that actually has nothing. Like, he was talking about FMVSS in a way which made me realize he doesn't know what that is.
He's every time he says something about AV regulation, it's wrong. Like, he's literally right. he thinks that there's, like, you know, that regulators have this, like, you know, miles per crash bar that's like the human level, that there's one level of, like, crashes per or miles per crash that, like, the average human has, and that if you clear that, then you can just go drive it. Like he makes these entire worlds up, these cinematic universes in his mind, and then he occupies them and pretends like there is no other
reality. Let me tell you the difference
and between it's astounding.
You and Elon Musk, the difference, Ed, is that Elon isn't saying this because he believes it to be true, but because he's hoping through stochastic effects of repetition that the general public will eventually believe it to be true, and then he will will it into reality to Tesla's benefit.
Yeah.
Don't answer that.
He's been remarkably successful at that.
So what he said, though, the way I understood it, was he was blaming Cruise's technical, quote unquote, technical inabilities or inadequacies for not getting FMVSS. But FMVSS is actually about the required items that you need in a vehicle physically, like an airbag that deploys out of a steering wheel because you have to have a steering wheel. So when companies like Nuro get an exemption, it's, and for Nuro, they are not, you know, their vehicles can't transport people, but they were the first to get the exemption, if I recall, and in part because it was lower speed, but the exemption was that they didn't have a steering wheel and that they didn't have pedals. So Musk sort of equating it to, he's mixing things up. And so it was funny because he was trying to burn Cruise, but, like, he failed at the joke because the joke was inaccurate, if that makes sense.
The irony is he's always talking about how Tesla's waiting for regulatory approval. Well, if it's just a software problem, like he's been saying since 2016, there's nothing in FMVSS that prevents you from updating the software in those cars to drive themselves. The only thing that would be a regulatory barrier for Tesla to make its cars self-driving the way it's been promising for so many years is if it were to physically take out the steering wheels and the human controls, which no one's talking about doing. And so he talks about a regulatory barrier for Tesla that doesn't – basically, his critique of this, you know, of GM is not only inaccurate, but it's completely hypocritical because it applies to him more than, or to Tesla more than it does to Cruise.
Let me tie some threads together here. But before I do, Patrick, you want to add anything to this conversation, to this topic? No. Yes?
No.
Okay.
All right, so
I have been working for several weeks on a blog post that I did not publish, and now it's too late to publish it, which is how Cruise might leapfrog Waymo. And here was my thesis, is that Waymo's burn has been going up for months as they expand more cities and they're firing on all cylinders. Good for them. They're clearly in the lead. While Cruise's burn has been going down because they've been cutting costs and trying to figure out how to right the ship. That if Cruise executed the reboot perfectly, they might have a shot to catch up to Waymo several years from now. But the only way that would happen is if there was some catastrophic external event, like market collapse, Waymo can't IPO, something happens. Motional is unable to raise money. There's a lot of trouble in the sector. However, so everything would have to go perfectly for Cruise and horribly for Waymo moving forward. And just a few days ago, prior to this recording, Waymo announced $5 billion commitment from Alphabet, which takes my thesis off the table because that buys them many years of runway, which means
even though, many years.
Well,
let's call it years.
How about this?
Multiple years.
Several years of growth. They're generating, their revenues are going up, which gets them in up and to the right with two lines that may hopefully eventually cross to profitability. Let's just say that the business case for Robotaxi AV, we now have the contours of a potentially successful example, whereas previously we didn't even have the contours. We just had shot in the dark. Let's hope it works out on an Excel spreadsheet. And so
but contours here's my pushback. Contours do not give you profitability. You can have revenue, but if your costs are also going up, by the way, which who knows what the Zeekr, Waymo, Robotaxi situations. I mean, I'm not saying it's bad that I think it's great that they're expanding and they're getting revenue for them, bottom line. But revenue is only one part of the scale. If your costs are also going up, which we don't have insight into.
Well, so in the Zeekr is supposed to, by the way, it's on the roads now, where since we're pivoting to kind of some Waymo talk here, it's starting to show up in San Francisco. We're seeing the Zeekr Robotaxi on the road. This is a huge step for Waymo because it gets them out of sort of that Jaguar I-Pay, sort of that era of we'll just take a vehicle that's available and robotaxify it, and getting to something that's more ground up. Cost reduction is a huge piece of that, and trying to get the service towards economic viability. I think one of the things is a little bit of I don't know how much of a hitch this is in the giddy up, but the tariffs. These are Chinese vehicles, and they're not coming over in huge volumes. But you know, every little thing on cost, is a problem. These are Chinese electric vehicles, and they're getting hit with tariffs. So that's kind of not ideal.
They might have to end up assembling them here, but let's just see them get on the road in a volume kind of way. Let's see. But I want
to
just
guess what, Kirsten, before we you take on to the next topic. I just want to say
it's not the next topic. I want to make a point here, which is going to give a nod to Rivian. So on how you can make revenue and still lose a lot of money. So the vehicles were, and Patrick, you probably followed it a little bit closer. I know the latest numbers were prior to the next gen version of the R1S and R1T was something around losing $33,000 for every vehicle made. It was much higher than that more than a year ago. So they're making the progress that needs to be done. But my point is this, it's proven to be a fairly popular vehicle that people like and are buying, and they're still losing tens of thousands of dollars on every vehicle they sell. Now they're moving in the right direction, but this is my analogy or example or illustration to show that you can be giving supposedly 50,000 rides per week and making money. But if your costs are outpacing that, you're going to plow through that $5 billion pretty fast, especially if you're expanding at the rate that I think Waymo would like to. You know, LA, Phoenix, San Francisco, Austin, you know, that's a big cost run up and operationally. So that $5 billion is good news for them. To me, was very curious that there weren't external investors this time.
Yeah. Patrick?
First off, so you're totally right. There's nothing like positive or negative margin to move the needle on how much cash you have on hand. I mean, once you get into operations, it's flows, not stocks. And if you have negative margin, yeah, you can burn through cash a lot more quickly once you actually are in business. But Waymo, I think, said that this $5 billion is going to come to them over years. And so not knowing what their burn rate is, I assume it is sufficient to some task, and that an IPO is at least years away. So they're probably good for a bit. I mean, $5 billion is a nice chunk of change.
Yeah, it is. I'm not saying that it's like $100 million that they're going to plow through. Like, it's interesting to me to see a company like Waymo getting $5 billion, and then like some of the smaller AV startups like Kodiak, you know, like hanging on with, you know, a fraction of that.
Yeah, but also the Kodiak's trying to, I mean, right, the scope of what they're trying to accomplish is pretty different.
It is, but like, I think that it also showed that some companies just have had to completely change how they know they're not going to get that type of money. So they have to change how they approach it.
And in this case, like you said, I mean, it is significant. I think the last round in 2020 that Waymo raised was so well timed. They were the first big sort of L4 sort of external raise. They raised right before sort of it became a lot harder to started to become a lot harder to. They raised $2.5 billion, and the really important thing was that in that round,
that was 2021.
Was it 2021?
So the last time they raised was 2021.
Okay, the first external round was 2020. I'm thinking of that one. Correct. where they brought in like the Canadian pension fund Fidelity. They basically, Google or Alphabet was able to de-risk its bet, right? So Alphabet has been funding Waymo all by itself since the DARPA challenges ended, you know? I mean, basically the entire time there's been an AV sector, this has been it. And Alphabet has been paying the bills themselves. The amount of money that they're all in on at this point is pretty wild. And you know, clearly I think that round signaled that they would like to bring in others to, again, like de-risk this investment and have it be something that others are sort of sharing in. The fact that they couldn't do it this time, I think, says a lot about the fundraising environment that we're in for folks in the mobility and particularly the autonomous vehicle sector, which we've also discussed quite a bit. But it also shows what I think is the thing that is most make or break. And like, Waymo has done a lot of things right to not just be in, but stay the leader in the space for a really long time. The number one factor, I think, above everything is investors with long-term vision. Like, this is, I still believe, one of the most important technologies of the next century, but it's just so hard for investors to, especially given the amount of capital, I'm not blaming them. This requires a lot of capital, investing billions of dollars over something that may be still, you know, a decade or so away from really hitting its stride economically, and certainly from fulfilling its potential. You know, you have to be a really long-term investor. And I think that, you know, Alphabet, maybe some of it is sunk cost at this point. Obviously, they have, you know, a strong business that they can pull cash out of to help support it. But I think fundamentally, and I think it'll be interesting to see if Amazon and other sort of folks who seem to have a similar opportunity sort of take this really long-term approach and say, look, even if, you know, it is a ways off from being a real viable business that we can spin out an IPO, that, you know, just folding up the tent like GM is doing, you know, is not really an option, that we have to have a long-term view of this.
Do you think that GM is folding up the tent by just scrapping the Origin, or do you? Yeah, think I guess
it's not fair to say they're scrapping up the tent. I mean, they're off ramping from what they were trying to do, right? Which, right, I don't think is a terrible thing. I think that we've discussed some of the challenges around their entire strategy before, and so I don't think that's a terrible idea. So yeah, you're right. Folding up the tent is probably not the right way to put it, but certainly rebooting in a very fundamental way.
Yeah.
The two things that really struck me is, in the last few months, for 5 or 6 years, people I knew, leadership amongst the big AV companies, were deeply concerned. So from the Uber crash of 2018, the Lane Hertzberg's death, through last year, there was a general feeling among AV company leadership that if there was a catastrophic event with fatalities amongst any of them, that the whole industry was in jeopardy. Tesla was considered an outlier because their crashes are pretty much ADAS, you know, an HMI cause, as opposed to, you know, AI cost. And the Cruise incident, juxtaposed against the Waymo, you know, peeling away, I think means that the AV industry has emerged from that, I don't want to say safe, but decoupled. Cruise is now decoupled from the other companies. Their problems are not necessarily attributed to the impossibility of AV, but to Cruise itself, because Waymo's been pulling away. So that's the first thing I think is really interesting. The second thing is, I've now taken 4 rides from where I live in Scottsdale, Arizona, to Phoenix Airport in a Waymo and been dropped off curbside. And people always ask me, oh, like when will Tesla to catch up with, when will Tesla, you know, show something and deploy robotaxis? And I'm like, no one has ever seen a Tesla with or without a safety operator pick up or drop off anyone curbside at an airport. And I haven't seen anyone else do it either except Waymo. And it worked perfectly every time. And to me, that's a bigger miracle than expanding service to new cities, because that is really hard to do. Really hard to do.
And I think that was sort of our critique of Cruise, right? Was that it was like they were so focused on scaling, new cities. And it was like, what are you scaling, right? And this has always been the thing in the AV sector over and over again in so many different – and the Origin is like a symbol of this, right? Of just like getting so far ahead on the strategy vision that you sort of assume that your execution has caught up with that, right? And yet it doesn't. And the AV sector is all about – execution, right? And getting it right. And I think, and I have to say, I mean, the way this is all shaken up, certainly like thinking about it from a public education perspective, which by the way, there's still so much work to be done around getting people to understand, you know, normies to kind of understand this technology, what's going on in the space. I've found in my conversations with people, you know, non-experts and stuff, like having Waymo kind of emerge as the leader in the space really, really helps kind of clarify some stuff. I think when there's a lot of players going around, it was, you could sort of lump them together. There's sort of the L4 thing, but it got confusing, and kind of being able to use Waymo as like just this example, because I think you can point to so many things that they've done to get it right that have like really important lessons about this technology and how to do it right. And taking it slow and, you know, not, you know, getting over your skis, not sort of leaning into the attitude that it's okay if people die because ultimately it'll be worth it because of the lives we're saving. There's all these sorts of things that kind of you can sort of pull out of their experience that help people understand like there's a right way and a wrong way to do this. You know, it sucks. I think as we've discussed before, like there needs to be more competition ultimately, and it'll be interesting to see where that comes from. But I think, you know, from that public education perspective, there is, it's interesting how Waymo is sort of like people are hearing about them more. People are aware of them more. People know that you go to San Francisco, you can get a driverless ride. There's something about the them coming into focus, I think, that is helping people understand, or giving the opportunity at least to explain in simple terms, like, hey, here's why a taxi works for this technology, whereas Tesla is trying to do it with private cars and it's not really going anywhere. And by the way, like, you know, Kyle can talk about how Cruise was, or Elon can talk about how Cruise was failing or whatever. And we've obviously had lots of criticisms of Cruise over the years. They got to driverless. Tesla still hasn't done that. So for Tesla to say that Cruise has failed at driving automation tech, yeah, pretty rich.
Kirsten?
I mean, not much more to say about that. Well, no, I wanted to go back to the funding for a minute. Because I was, while you were talking, I was looking up really quickly to remind myself. So when Kravchuk was still CEO of Waymo, that's when they landed the $2.25 billion. It later, another $700 million came on. And that was the first external round. And then in 2021, we saw $2.5 billion with all these, it looks like the same external investors as the time before. So Andreessen Horowitz, AutoNation, the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, Fidelity, Magna, T. Rowe Price, Silver Lake, and Tiger Global. So what I found interesting in this round, and I don't know if you have an opinion on it, is that they've doubled the investment, right? So it was 2.25 and then ended up being a little bit more than 2.5. Then a year later, another 2.5. And now we have $5 billion, but we don't know the terms of the deals. We don't know. I theorize that it might be gated, although I've been told by those familiar with the deal that it is not. I also, you know, if you read the tweet from the co-CEO, Takedra Mawakana, she says up to $5 billion. So is it $5 billion or not? Is there... like they have hit milestones or what. So there's a lot that we don't know about. I find it interesting that number though, and how they landed on it and how Alphabet is now back carrying that entire load. They didn't disclose any other external investors. So I don't know if you have an opinion on that, of what that means. Is it that Alphabet is so convinced that they want to be part of it? Is it that the terms of the deal weren't great? or, you know, is it a good or bad reflection? I'm trying to figure that out. And I don't know, maybe Patrick, you have a sense of what this means. Is it good or bad? Cause you were at Rivian when they were, you know, raising a lot of money. So what's the behind the scenes thing that we should be paying attention to?
My guess is that first of all, this is a realization as we've gone in and out of hype on AVs that Alphabet knows they're kind of the only one in a position to fund this the way that it needs and to take the longest possible view. And my guess is that they put $5 billion on the table over some period of time and said, this funding's here for you. Maybe Waymo goes public before they get to the end of that period. So that would be an explanation for up to $5 billion. But I think it just represents basically an admission. I mean, like the fact that this is a larger round than we've seen, it's an admission that like until Waymo's ready to go public, this is really on Alphabet.
Yeah. And luckily they can, right? I mean, and I think that was sort of, you know, one of the problems with GM, the GM situation is that GM simply doesn't have the kind of business that pours out cash the way, you know, Alphabet's core businesses do. And so they just, you know, it's the car business, you know, you've got a lot of demands on your capital and only so much of it. And the markets aren't exactly, you know, pouring it onto you if you need more. And so they simply, you know, to some extent, this is like a poker game, right? Where it's just like, you got to have the big stack in order to get to the river, right?
I'm just going to say that I hope, and in fact, I'm quite confident that if there are any gates or milestones that Waymo has to pass through, that they are not going to be anything like the milestones that Cruise had with GM. And there are other investors back in the day. If I recall that there was some like arbitrary list of milestones that I think Cruise came up with. They had to pass through so many safety metrics and go driverless and then expand hours to get more tranches of money. And that those, what's the old adage? It's like if you pick the wrong metric, you just are trapped within like metric thinking. I forget what the rule is. But those metrics didn't in any way correlate for Cruise into actual service revenue or profits. And so they were meaningless, essentially meaningless. And in this case, if whatever the milestones are, I love them. I hope there's something like, you know, city added with X numbers of rides, which is much more meaningful than some arbitrary thing of like ODD expansion. It's not the same.
To be clear, like from what I've been hearing is that it's not gated. So, you know,
good.
I theorized it as it was, but I've since heard that it's not. So I don't know if there are any, I mean, I'm sure that the company itself has internal milestones. It doesn't sound like it's necessarily tied to unlocking more money.
If anyone could get it right, it's them, and I'm hopeful.
One just interesting thing, though, you know, Fidelity did participate in that last sort of outside investor round for Waymo. They didn't in this one, obviously. Alphabet is doing it. Fidelity's not completely out of the AV space broadly, in that they are. I'm just noticing Applied Intuition, which has been one of those really cool companies that's been kind of kicking ass very quietly in the AV and sort of automotive AI space, let's call it. They just raised a $300 million secondary right after a $250 million round Series E. So that's 550, yeah. Like just in the last, you know, so for a company in the space, that's a good deal. Fidelity was in this most recent secondary round. So Fidelity is not out of investing. So that kind of investor is not gone. But I think reading through the lines here, you know, Applied Intuition is like, it's like an AI services company. And I think that goes to the sort of narrative of what's hot now.
To be clear, it's a simulation company.
Yes, but it's service. It's broadly speaking, services. Yes, simulation is a big part of what they do. I don't think that's all that they do, though. They're branded as an AI company, and this is just speculation, but I think like the challenge with a Waymo is that like, you know, everyone knows that there's still a ways to go to get to that point where it's an economically viable thing. And there's still just a question of how far that is and how much capital it takes to get there. Whereas an AI services company, you know, is making revenue right now and doesn't have the insane kind of capital requirements that it takes to build out a robotaxi network. So I think it's probably just it's not that, you know, outside investors are abandoning AV broadly. It's just they're scared by these super big moonshot kind of projects.
What I would say, not even it's not even that it's a moonshot, that it's because if you look at like the investment going into end to end, there is a lot of investment going to that too, like Wave, where that does feel in a way like a moonshot. It does feel harder. But I think the big difference is that operationally speaking, Waymo requires a lot. It is not just, you know, it is hundreds of people and hardware it's like a car company or something.
Yeah, it's its own version of
Kool-Aid. And so that is a heavy load to carry. And so I could see, you know, especially, institutional investors like Fidelity being like, okay, the hype cycle's over, kind of, for AVs, unless, of course, you slap AI at the end of your name. And and so what's the safer, non, like, asset heavy? They're going kind of asset light. It seems like that's what's happening here.
So I have two, unlike Ed, I have two 30-second things to say, and then I am done. And here you go.
Okay.
Was an op-ed in the New York Times last week about a guy who's trying to teach his son to drive in a Tesla. And he was like, yeah, I wonder if he's actually learning. This is a good system, X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, man, the New York Times, you need to stop having people write about HMI, ADAS, driver's ed, Tesla, and autopilot until you get someone who doesn't know what the hell they're talking about. There was not one mention of series versus parallel automation, like the different forms of ADAS, HMI, nothing. It was, I'm sorry to say, one of the stupidest things I've ever read in a major media outlet about driving automation. And my second comment, and it's related, is the term software-defined vehicle has been all the rage. There's conferences, Motor Trend gives awards for it, X, Y, and Z. Software-defined vehicle for me is the dumbest and stupidest, and I'm not concept, but branding for decision makers in automotive and investment. Here's why. Customers, people who buy cars, do not care. Every vehicle must be defined as must be a customer-defined vehicle. What will people pay for? Customers do not care how much software is in it. They only care that it works. And people bought cars before software went into them. They're going to keep buying them long after it's jam-packed. The only question is how much money will be wasted building subscription-based apps into cars, okay, that no one wants to buy. That's it. That's the only question. Go ahead.
I just want to make one tweak to that. Please, no one use the dumb marketing term in your future advertisement of customer defined vehicle, because I can't handle that. If
you
do,
you've got to pay Alex a licensing fee.
It's also
have to use it in the marketing.
No.
So
look, Colin Barnion, former guest on this podcast, Mr. Driving Monitoring System expert, has been publishing every week about how many bad DMS systems are going into new cars. And people complain, more beeps, more just bad. And I predicted on this show that bad DMS implementations would lead people to never want cars that force DMS on them. And DMS is guaranteed in all vehicles in the coming years. And if it's too intrusive, then the software, the driver assistance linked to it, no one's going to want to pay for it. They're going to want to disable it or turn it off, which means this whole thing will be a dead end. And it's all a function of software-defined vehicle becoming all the rage in how cars are designed. Of course we need software, but it's got to be good and go into products people will pay for.
But it's not just about that. The reason DMS is so important is because there is still this push to make the cars that normal people go out and buy and own and drive self-driving or sort of self-driving or kind of near to self-driving or almost, but you know, hopefully it's someday self-driving, right? And there's a story in the New York Times about Masayoshi-san at SoftBank. And I just love the imagery of this summoning auto executives from around the world to his tatami room in Tokyo to sell them on the idea of AI driving automation in the cars that OEMs make and sell. Interestingly, the only companies that were named as having been in these meetings were Honda, Nissan, and Uber. So sort of like not big names in driving automation tech. And his pitch is is, you know, that this is, it's sort of the AI first thing, and reading between and no HD maps and reading between the lines, it sounds like Masa-san is out personally pitching for his investment on Wave to executives like that. And we had Wave's CEO on our last show. So go listen to that to get a sense of what they're doing. For me, the big takeaway from that show, and I'd love to maybe talk to Alex Kendall a little bit more in case I don't quite have this right, but it really sounded to me like their go-to-market strategy was level two, that this sort of whole, and that's what Tesla, right? Tesla is the prototype for this AI first approach in sort of, you know, cars that people buy and own. You know, if this is ever going to get traction, right? If this is going to go somewhere, like, good DMS has to be a critical part of that whole thing. So that's certainly an interesting situation.
Kirsten, take us home.
As Ed trails off. Well, I think that we've covered everything. We didn't talk about the Robotaxi reveal, but really we're going to have plenty of time to talk about that because it's going to keep getting delayed. So it's not like it's pressing news that we need to.
Well, the nice thing is we're also entering an age of zero scarcity. So like none of us will have to work. So we'll have nothing to do but sit around and talk about Tesla's robotaxis all day.
Oh, geez. That's a terrible future. So on that note.
Thanks for sitting through this, Patrick. Kirsten.
Yeah, Patrick, thanks for giving your 2 cents on a few important details. I didn't ask you anything. I think that'll get you in trouble. And thanks to our listeners to tuning in to another episode of the Autonicast.